Our panel this morning, Sinead O'Carroll, is editor with thejournal.ie. Donico O'Bacon is professor of international relations at DCU. Michelle Murphy is research and policy analyst at Social Justice Ireland. And Cormac Lucy is an economics columnist with the Sunday Times. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Sinead, would you just tell us what we know about the budget so far, just to set the frame of the conversation?
Yeah, like always, we pretty much know everything that's going to be in the budget by Tuesday, apart from a little bit of tinkering. We won't have any big shocks like Truss gave the UK press corps during the week. $3 billion in one-off cost of living measures and $6.7 billion in tax cuts are the headline figures. People who earn about 50,000 will see themselves benefit to the tune of about 500 a year. Tax ban, the 40% tax band is going to increase by 2,500. So if you're paying some of your income at 40% tax, you'll be paying less of it from that measure. One-off payments for child benefit, they're looking at probably will double for a month in November, as well as a lot of other weekly welfare benefits. So that'll be kind of an extra Christmas bonus paid in November, I guess, to welfare benefit people getting welfare benefits and child benefit. €600 energy credit, obviously because of the energy price crisis, that will probably be in three tranches of €200, one paid before Christmas. There is a not a disagreement, but there's an unknown, either €10 or €15 added to welfare payments.
Or €12.50.
Yeah. So we'll probably find out that on Tuesday. Some things then outside of that will, the Green Party obviously want the 20% cut in public transport costs extended to make that a more permanent measure. The obvious 50 cent on cigarettes is going to happen, nothing on alcohol. So that's kind of been the theme of the last few years, that, you know, 50 cents get added onto the box, 20 cigarettes, but nothing on alcohol. And then the expansion of free GP care is probably the other big one. So even more people and children coming into that bracket that can go and not have to pay the 50-60 euro fee to the GPs.
So Cormac Lucy, what's not to like? We have a load of extra money and we're doling it out to everybody.
Well, it's a bit of a sort of a chicken McNugget budget, in the sense that we're getting a box of bits here and bits there, rather than a steak budget where there's one big thing that you can get your teeth into. You know, Sinead adverted there to the mini budget they had in Britain, and they brought the top rate. They abolished the top rate of income tax. So there's a big measure that people will remember.
Whereas a big measure for millionaires,
for the better off. But it was also a bit of a political poison pill that Gordon Brown brought in his last budget in his administration, daring the Conservatives to get rid of it. And they've been toying around with it, and now they've gone and done it.
Okay.
Whereas the budgets here, I suppose partly because we have coalition governments, and therefore there isn't one party making one big bang impact. Rather, you have a group of parties, each with conflicting objectives. The big figure for me was on the front of the Sunday Independent. Coalition in last minute scramble to seal €14 billion deal. So that is equivalent to €2,500 for every man, woman and child in the country. So the tax receipts for the state have been extraordinarily strong, and that gives Pascal Donoghue and Michael McGrath an extraordinarily large amount of money to play with. And rather than going for one big thing, they're going for a lot of smaller things.
Okay. Michelle Murphy.
Well, I suppose a lot of what we have on the front pages of the papers, a lot of these are just one-off measures. You know, so you're looking at a one-off double child welfare payment, for example, the one-off energy credits, the one-off double payment.
But I suppose there is what we hope is a one-off problem at the moment as well.
Yeah,
so
but
there's two
strands
to this. Mm-hmm. One is the permanent increases and the other is to give people a dig out right now, isn't
absolutely
it?
Absolutely. Yeah. But I suppose inadequacy has been a permanent problem. That's the challenge for people on low pay and people on fixed incomes. And what I don't see in any of the headlines or the kites that have been flown over recent weeks is how government is actually going to deal with that, because income inadequacy is not just a one-off problem. It's a recurrent problem. And last year when the budget was announced in December, the Parliamentary Budget Office did a really interesting report looking at, we don't index welfare rates in this country to either wages or inflation. So, for example, the real value of the pension was €30 lower than what was announced on budget day. The real value of the job seekers payment was 192, not 208. So that shows the challenge that they face. So you need more than one-off measures here. Also disappointed not to see anything.
No, the increases to social welfare and pensions are more than one-off. They are permanent increases.
But what we're not seeing here is you need a minimum of €20 if you're going to deal with income inadequacy at that level for people on fixed incomes. You know, what you're seeing, 10, 15...
How much will that
15,
cost every year, did Social Justice...
Justice Ireland, you're looking at over €1 billion. But if you look at what they are going to spend on a one-off energy credit, that is not in any way targeted, and you take into account what was spent in February, that's €1.6 billion. That's more than the tax budget, but package, you know, I suppose the recurring tax package that's been announced. We were told in February they couldn't target it. They need to do something immediately. It seems like they're going to run into real challenges with the businesses scheme as well, because, you know, it's said, and one source says revenue knows the turnover of businesses, but they don't know their energy bills. So what you're seeing is a really big measure that's not targeted. And the OECD have said it should be targeted. We've said it should be targeted, the ESRI, at households who need it most. Not a one-off credit, energy credit again. Well, three of them actually at this point, going to holiday homes and people who don't need it. It should be targeted people who need it most. So for us, we'd be really concerned. We're not seeing a €20 well, it depends what comes out on Tuesday, but I don't see anything about a €20 increase or ongoing measures to deal with income inadequacy. And for us, that's really concerning. And neither do I see anything in there in terms of the surplus and investing it, because housing and energy are the two key drivers in the cost of living. We need to invest in housing.
We'll come back to housing in a minute. Dominic, I'll bring you in a second. OK, can I go back to you on that, Cormac? Michelle, probably coming from a different place to you, but is largely kind of agreeing with you that this is like throwing around, not snuff it away, but like that there's no strategy here really, is there?
What I find most disappointing, if you just view this from a Social Justice Ireland perspective, what I find most disappointing about what seems to be the government's reaction on Budget Day is that we've got an energy crisis that is likely to disproportionately hit less well-off people because they're spending a higher share of their income on energy. And we have inflation back. If I were Pascal Donoghue, I would be looking to enshrine a more systematic solution to both energy problems and inflation. So what do I mean by that? I would bring in a separate consumer price index for the less well-off, so that rather than them getting, let's say, compensated for general inflation, if it happens that they're facing a higher rate of inflation than the rest of the population, I would use that.
So would you agree with the €20 needed on pensions and social welfare? Yeah.
And the other thing
that would have eaten up then, and given that that's permanent, and I think we had, there was €1.1 billion there for tax, that would probably have eaten up any tax cuts for people in the higher rate. Would you say that's a fair trade-off at the moment?
Well, they're talking about €14 billion to play with, so they've a lot of money to play with. It could be at the expense of other spending priorities.
Yeah.
But I do think that there's a case for indexing the less well-off to a customised price index, and B, if inflation goes above a certain level, let's say 6% per annum, there's a case for quarterly increments in welfare payments. So rather than seeing your spending power eroding and having to wait 12 months for something to be done about it, there's a case for greater automaticity.
So people on social welfare get compensated for inflation at all times.
If it goes above a certain level.
And that other people might not need that, people who aren't working. Okay. Dominica, your opening thoughts on all of that?
Well, I guess working in the university, we tend to look out and see how it's going to affect the education sector and students who have just come back. And I can say
they're getting €500 off their fees.
€500 off the fees, which will be a welcome relief for students. It's currently 3,000. I think what will worry the third level sector is that if that's not matched by, you know, an allocation from the government to meet the deficit now caused by the loss of that €500, effectively it's going to be a cut in the funding for universities, and that will lead to higher student lecturer ratios. It'll lead to, you know, poor student services. So on the one hand, it seems to be giving something to students, but if it's not matched by increased government funding, it'll be difficult to see how the same services can be rendered for less money. Secondly, there's also the housing issue, which I mean, we got an email, an all staff email there a few weeks ago, saying that for every on-campus place we had, you know, in terms of accommodation, we had 7 applications. And, you know, that's, I think, unprecedented. And there's an obvious solution there of building more on-campus accommodation for students because they're competing now with ordinary renters.
No, the government seems to be saying we are offering, the money is there if the colleges want to build it. Some people are under the impression a lot that colleges prefer to build buildings that are not student accommodation, that are more...
Oh, I can't speak for all colleges,
to the
but
arts
I know
and
certainly
the
in DCU...
Is there a bit of an epidemic of building buildings in colleges, though?
I do hear that. I can't speak for all colleges, but I can say at DCU, I know we have planning permission for 1,200 additional on-campus accommodation.
Affordable, okay. Affordable is it? Because you hear, you know, the Students' Union come on radio and they give extraordinary figures for how much they're being charged for campus as well as off-campus accommodation.
It can be as high as 14,000 per annum. Though at DCU, I know it's between 5,000 and 7,000, because what they do is they rent out buildings during the summer and that subsidises the cost of student accommodation. But as everybody knows, the cost of building has gone up astronomically. So, you know, universities are not, you know, private enterprises. They rely on state funding. They can only build if the money is put there for them. They would certainly like, I know, in those areas like DCU, which have, you know, a large amount of space, which they can still build on, they would like to have more students on campus. It benefits everybody, most particularly students.
And okay. I think that's a theme throughout the budget, and probably Michelle would have got to this as well. And on top of the income, is a lot of income is going on rent. So Leo Varadkar has says there will be rent relief for renters and there will be relief for landlords as well to try and get it from both sides. And one of the only measures that I've seen for years that actually would make a renter feel a little bit better going into Tuesday is that they might be linking that rent relief with long-term leases. And honestly, we've been talking about this housing crisis for so long. That is the first sentence I've read in a long, long time. And just a personal observation when I was reading things, I seem to have moved myself from young person renter into mother with and homeowner, and it feels like this is the first time that politicians are actually talking to me.
Really?
For sure. So I'm kind of looking at the people who are like a couple of years behind me saying, yeah, you're still in that situation where, you know, they don't care how much rent you're paying. Like they don't care that it seems unsustainable. They don't care that you're going to be in your late 30s by the time you're not paying rent anymore. So, you know, the little tinkering with the tax, probably, you know, what Gormx was saying, it's going to feel a little bit like a chicken nugget. Like
okay.
It's not going to feel
bring you
enough.
Back in a sec. Just to be Michelle on that. Are you viewing that as a positive, the idea that there would be a tax credit for renters and that?
I mean, it's a small relief because they're one of, when you take into housing costs, they have one of the highest risks of poverty. But what would really concern me, there's a story in the Daily Mail about how the Department of Housing this year, the underspend in terms of the capital budget is 32%. That's a huge concern. So we're not even building, and like the targets in Housing for All, they're not sufficient in the first place. But the fact that we're not even meeting those targets is a huge concern for us, because you have a story also that the Simon community, so that's 290,000 people who are sort of couch surfing, they're not really fully counted in the homelessness figures. We don't actually know, or the department isn't 100% sure who is actually renting in this country, depending if your landlord is registering the property or not. So it's hugely
concerning.
And then
Rory Hearn yesterday, again, that extraordinary figure of 1 in 10 of the population adults living at home with their parents. So there's a massive kind of
But the fact that we're not even spending the capital budget that we have, which is insufficient. I mean, we think it's Social Justice Ireland, I think you should actually double the social housing
to target. 8 billion.
Yeah, but and double the social housing target, which
the
would
target, which we free what up about is the six, current target?
The current target is 90,000. There's about 133,000 homes really in need, or households, because they're people on HAP, which is a failure rate of 26%. Yet we're probably looking at HAP as one of the other, you know, budget supports around housing. So it's not
but
a
I
secure accommodation.
But I suppose HAP is keeping, I don't know,
and
you hear 60,000, 90,000 tenants in
housing. But you would free
in,
up 60,000 properties then in the private rental sector if you did invest in the social housing and increase those targets. But the fact that we're not even delivering the cost rental homes, that's hugely concerning for people.
Now, we checked in with the Department of Housing on Friday and said, look, what are the up-to-date figures? And look, we can only take them at face value. We said, what's the actual real delivery going to be this year? And they said 9,000 social houses being built this year, which, like, when you look back, when I was reading Rory Hearn's book, The Golden Age of Building Social Housing, that was kind of the figures we were at. If you were doing that every year, you probably wouldn't be bad. Cormac, you wanted to come in there.
Well, I was just going to reference the same story in the Mail on Sunday that Michelle referenced. And they were making the point, Colin McGurk there, that capital expenditure on housing is 20% less this year than last year, despite it having been projected to increase by over 60%. So it's all very well ministers making grand announcements in Dáil Éireann, but we need to see the execution. And I think there's too little attention paid to strategic thinking on things like adjusting welfare to match customised price rises, and on delivery of measures in terms of, you know, where's the beef on the ground in terms of houses getting built and being made available.
Well, the beef on the ground, I will say, again, according to our friends in the Department of Housing, is 9,000 social houses being built this year, I think.
Yeah, but yeah. If you look at household formation in Ireland, it's running at 30, 40,000 new houses would be needed a year, just to stop the problem getting worse.
But that's only social housing.
Agreed.
Obviously, the target in general isn't at 33,000 a year, which they're saying they won't get to this year, but that'll be the average over the 10 years.
But they're also not dealing, Brendan, with the pent-up demand for the years when we weren't building houses. And that's pent-up private demand and pent-up social demand.
And all those adult children living at home with their parents.
So what, does anyone have a... What's the answer here, I wonder? Cormac, as an economics guy, what...
To be honest, if I were made minister, we've had four ministers in the last 10 years, Simon Coveney, Alan Kelly, we now have Dara O'Brien, and they've all promised reforms. I think it would be great if the next Taoiseach made him or herself Minister for Housing, declare a national emergency. I think they need accelerated planning to force through new houses. That means downplaying protests. There are trade-offs. There's no good choices. They're just trade-offs.
Okay.
But I think a lot of it is
so
about
technocratic
and go for it and make it priority number one for 3 years and nail the government's colours to the mast on success or failure on this. I also think there's an argument in Dublin, this is a bit wacky, to reclaim Dublin Bay, to build a wall between Howth and Dunleary and build there.
Yeah, didn't Harry Crosby has suggested this in the past? There is some kind of plan or some vague work done on this, isn't it? That it would be.
Yeah,
but do we need to create more land around Dublin? Because, like, Colin McCarthy is blue in the face from telling us there's plenty land inside the M50 that we could be using.
I think if we have a major problem that we have not solved for several years, we can't afford to wait and see which measure works and which doesn't. We have to try everything we can do and get on with it.
Yeah. What would you say, Michelle? If you were Minister for Housing in the morning, what?
God, well, it has been supposedly a priority, but number one, the plans aren't based on, you know, accurate figures and accurate numbers. So if you don't have the right targets, then you're not going to get the right output. So number one, obviously you need to increase supply. Our focus would obviously be on social housing supply and cost rental supply, because that is also an asset for the state. I suppose what happened was, for what, 30 years now, we've relied, the state has taken a step back, we've relied on the private market. So you need to double your social housing target, number one. That's just a basic. That would require another 1.4 billion this year alone in terms of delivering social housing.
Then so look double at the target to how many years would
so
you be building?
And we've 20%. For example, the European average would be 20%. That's what your stock of housing, 20% of that should be social.
And
we have 9%. So
nine and ten.
Then you're looking at, so what land does the state own? Can we build housing on that land? Looking at the AHBs, that the housing that they already have stays as social housing and cost rental homes. Because if you don't, housing and energy are the two biggest drivers of the cost of living. And energy and the cost of energy is not going to go down in the immediate future. So we need to be investing in things like housing, but also our energy infrastructure, our energy storage capacity, our wind energy, so that we can bring down the cost of energy for people.
You brought in a lot of other omni-shambles is there as well.
I don't think we'll even have time
to go into the wind situation today, but the wind situation looks pretty dire according to the Business Post. Donica, politically, what Cormac is saying there and Michelle backing up, and it makes a lot of sense, does it, for the government to just stake their claim on this and say, this is an emergency, this is what we're going to do? Are we at one of those moments in history where a big strategic move like this is required?
Oh, absolutely. And what strikes me as a historian at heart is how we managed to do this in times where we were far less resourced. If you look at I was reading a book there recently, Ruth McManus, an excellent work on Dublin 1910 to 1950 housing. She's in the DCU's Department of History, and it's remarkable. Merino, Drumcondra, Glasnevin, where I live, all built in the 30s, 40s and 50s. When, you know, when Fianna Fáil came to power in 32, it was during a global depression. There was very little money. There was very little money to be got in the international market. And yet they built, they cleared the slums and they
You see, you wonder if there was a recession, Cormac, would we actually have a better chance of building some houses? Would we have a better chance of getting some builders and everything else?
Possibly. I think one issue that is being a bit overlooked when we're critical of the government is that Ireland is very much part of the international market for labour. And we had a huge recession 15 years ago, loads of emigration. In the meantime, we've had loads of immigration. So it'll be difficult for any government to adapt to the huge. We're like one of these people who's a binge eater and a binge dieter, and we're going from really really thin to really really overweight, and we're trying to get a suit of clothes that will work for us under all circumstances, and that's difficult. So I think that's part of the problem, that we are integrated, and it would have been sort of mentally easier for De Valera and his ministers back in the 1930s to work this out. But I think the size of the problem is so great that governments just need to seize this and nail their colours to the mast and get on with it.
Is there any chance that, and this like this is the wishful thinking you do hear from young people, is there any chance that a substantial correction in the market might help this situation? We see already that if there's quantitative tightening and there isn't so much money flowing around the world to get into every looking for every kind of asset it can buy, we can see a tightening on that already. Is there any chance that housing is going to get freed up, the prices are going to come down, do you think?
Well, there's an individual problem for a couple or a household trying to find a house. And they may have savings, and it may make their situation easier if house prices drop. And I think they're likely to drop in the next 18 months.
Enough to matter, enough
not
to make a difference?
Maybe down, maybe 10%.
Yeah.
But that won't fix the collective problem, that there are more people than there are houses available. So whatever the price is, that doesn't change the calculus of people versus houses.
Yeah. And even if the so-called vulture funds start selling up stock, there still aren't more houses in
Correct.
The country, essentially. They're
Correct.
Moving around between sectors, yeah. Listen, Sinead, just as an add-on to this, somebody texted in there, how come a country of less than 5 million has so many problems? You know what? If we were a bigger country, we'd probably have less problems. Another problem, and it's weird that young people are exercised about a lot of things. They don't seem as exercised about this in a way, because I don't know if they're making the connection here, but Colin McCarthy in the Sunday Indo, keeping pension age at 66 is unfair on the young generation.
Yeah, I actually agree that I'm not sure if people have got as angry about this as they should, or if there's some, like, say, take Sinn Féin, for instance. I think Sinn Féin, most of their party members would see themselves as much more a party for young people and young workers. But they want to keep the pension age. They actually want to reverse it back to 65, but haven't told young people, you'll be paying an extra 2,500 a year in your off your payslip to make sure. And by the time you're 65, it's definitely not going to be still a 65 retirement age. So I think there's this feeling from younger people, yeah, it's fair that people should, you know, get to stop working at 65. I, you know, don't want my parents, who maybe has had a physical labouring job, you know. So there's this idea of fairness, I think, amongst young people, but they don't realise, well, actually, it's really unfair on you. Colin McCarthy does a very good job in the Sunday Independent today explaining it. There's a piece by Julia Maloney as well in the Sunday Independent talking about, she's an emigrant, so she has left and she has obviously a better rental situation in France. She has, you know, but better overall, like, standard of living, she says, compared to other young people in Ireland, basically because of the housing crisis. But she says what she doesn't have is that collective community spirit that, you know, people can rally together and ask for something, because she's in a more disparate expat community. So I was thinking, God, that's the same thing with the pensions thing. Like, you know, young people have to realise we're not going to be, well, I kind of can't put myself in that bracket anymore, but, you know, we're not going to be retiring at 65, and we are going to be paying for this for the rest of our careers. And I don't think young people have probably realised that, probably in the interest of their own fairness, thinking their parents.
And now we'll queue a load of texts coming in from older people saying we did our bit, we paid our taxes, we looked after the generation before us, etc.
But this they're asking for a lot more out of the generation behind them, I think, and especially seeing that, like, you know, by their 20s they were able to get mortgages and houses, you know, things that people, it's just impossible now for people in their 20s to do. So the idea of being young lasts for a lot longer now, you know, people, that's just not going to happen.
Aging, which is a real success story. People are living longer, but the proportion of people over 85 is going to grow. So all those young people now paying their taxes, they're not only paying for the pension changes, but they'll be paying for the health service. All the, they're going to have to fund all the other things.
Is it correct that we are paying people pensions from the age of 65 when in the past they might have lived a few years after that, and now they can be around for another 30-40 years?
I certainly don't like the term pension time bomb. It's actually a huge success story for the state that people are living longer, but I suppose what I find disappointing is there's people out there now who don't have pension coverage. That's the point. We didn't look at those, you know, women who were forced to leave the labour force, for example, due to the marriage ban, or who are dependent on a partner for what type of contributory pension or not that they may get. They've just been forgotten about. You know, it's like it's.
But do we need to put up the pension age?
Well, what we've said, 66, but people can work until 70. But you need to look at the numbers of how you're actually going to fund it. And that's the thing. And I suppose the Commission on Taxation and Welfare, you know, published their report last week, and it's not just the pension you have to fund, it's all the other things, the healthcare system, the education system, how you're going to fund your energy costs, and what's the labour force, and are you going to have to look beyond income taxes for something like that? How you fund it is
on that
the real
specific
issue.
Question about what age, it probably goes back to Cormac's point, is that there's probably not one size fits all. Like, I think, you know, depending on the job you do, but no one here is probably saying, you know, a builder who's labouring should work till they're 70 to make sure that they can get the contributions that they need to get a pension. But if it's somebody, you know, some people take cases to the WRC because they want to continue on past 65, but their company doesn't let them. So, you know, there's these kind of anomalies that are in the system at the moment that you can look at.
Okay, a couple of other problems I want to touch on before we get to a break, seeing as we're doing an inventory of all the problems of this small country. Donica, you picked out Barry Cowan, mm-hmm. Barry Cowan having a kind of a solo run, going for the heart of Fianna Fáil, and maybe it would appeal to Cormac, a kind of a big issue. He's saying basically we need a Donegal O'Malley moment on childcare.
I thought this was a very interesting article, and combined with John Drennan's analysis of the kind of recent Fianna Fáil gathering and the impending Ardèche, both of them are kind of addressing a similar problem. The argument is that Fianna Fáil has kind of lost its identity. It hasn't kind of communicated clearly what it stands for to the electorate. And Barry Cowan's point is that Fianna Fáil's success, like any venture, depends on its ability to reinvent itself as time progresses, and that Lamass managed to do that in the 1960s after a terrible 1950s for the party by, you know, reversing policy and, you know, going for, instead of for self-sufficiency, for going for international trade. And then, yeah, Donegal O'Malley, that huge moment which was out of the blue of free education, it captured the imagination, and Fianna Fáil kind of then managed to ride the zeitgeist of the 1960s quite successfully. He says they need another moment like that. It's almost saying that it's new Fianna Fáil, like new Labour under Tony Blair. And he picks one point, which he says he'd be pushing hard at the impending Ardèche. And it's one that I think chimes with an awful lot of people. And that would be free, childcare, state-funded childcare. Because I certainly firmly believe that there are some things that are far too important to be outsourcing. We know what they are. Things like defence, things like justice, things like public transport. Childcare is one of those things. And, you know, we're working on an outdated model of one parent working, which was 50 years ago. Two parents are working now. Someone has to look after children. And
I think the main shift is it's not a choice anymore. You know, this idea that like a two income house is a choice. It's not. You have to have a two income house to be able to, you know, even go to a bank and get a mortgage. You know, you'll be laughed at if you're a one income house and you're trying to get a mortgage. And if you're having kids, it's impossible to get long term rental security. So you have to try and buy a house. So it's a massive shift. You have to have a two-income house, or then you don't have to, obviously, but like it's, you know, that's what our society is
made. And essentially, in Dublin, and look, we've all been through this and it's been said before, two children in Dublin is enough to make your childcare bill the same as your mortgage.
One child is enough to make it. One child is enough, depending on the age. But if you're putting a 1 year old into childcare, you're not getting any of those ECC hours yet. So you're talking about a second mortgage with one child. Yeah.
But that, you know, a publicly funded childcare system, which we would support, that would cost significant amount of money. But it also runs counter to a lot of what the state is doing at the moment, because obviously you need to staff it. You know, instead of outsourcing everything to the private sector. And I read that article with interest, because I suppose what I didn't see really was much detail as to how, you know, Fianna Fáil are actually going to deliver this. They were going to engage with stakeholders. I mean, a lot of that engagement has already been done. All the research, the reports and everything are written. That the fact of the matter is they have to begin to implement it. And I suppose, you know, if they really want a Donna O'Malley moment, they need to
I don't think this is actual policy yet, but do we need to be paying a lot more tax if we're going to want to live in this country where there's free childcare, doubling of social housing, all that kind of thing? Are we into a different model of an economy then?
Well, I think that's the danger. For me, the problem with political management in this country, it's not a lack of ideas or a lack of concepts or a lack of things to promise. It's a lack of execution. And everywhere we look, there is poor execution. There's great high-minded ideals, large amounts of money being committed, and then poor management and delivery. And I kind of get worried that rather than fix the delivery and the management, that politicians look for the next area to make big promises in, that, as you indicated, have big bills.
Ian Guider arguing in the Business Post today, he said 10 things to do in the budget, and one of them he's saying is do a comprehensive review of all state spending and look at what
we we've already seen that in childcare, that like the money that's been pumped into it has just not gone to the people who were meant to receive it, who are the working
I need
parents.
To take a break. Okay, Sinead O'Carroll, Donegal back on, Michelle Murphy and Cormac Lucy staying with us.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back, Sinead O'Carroll, Donegal back on, Michelle Murphy and Cormac Lucy still with us. Donica, the Northern Ireland census seems to mean whatever you want it to mean, depending on where you're coming from. You picked out a piece in the Sunday Ender by Sam McBride. United Ireland backers don't want to end up like regretful Brexiters. An interesting little piece, isn't it?
He is. He is a great journalist, and it is a great article. And he's been really on the money this week, writing in the Belfast Telegraph and now in the Sunday Independent. Generally, I mean, his take on it is that, look, you know, on the one hand, you can say this is everything, Catholics overtaking Protestants or people of a Catholic background. And of course, those who are arguing for a border poll would attach particular significance to that. And of course, he says it's more complicated than that. But on the other hand, it's not nothing. You know, the North was established to create a permanent majority for people of a Protestant background. And that is now, that raison d'etre is now diminished. And the North will have to, I guess, he also made the argument during the week, which I thought was a very important one, that the biggest threat to the Union, it doesn't come from Sinn Féin, doesn't come from this new Catholic, you know, plurality in Northern Ireland. It comes from those who profess themselves to be attached to the Union. They have to create, or at least put themselves forward to be creating an inclusive Northern Ireland, one that can, you know, is livable for people of different persuasions and none. And if it doesn't do that, it's in danger. And then on the bigger issue, he points out that next weekend in Dublin, in the Three Arena, which I think can hold about 10,000 people, he said it's hosted Robbie Williams and Bob Dylan. There'll be a huge event talking about the future of Ireland post-border poll. But he says it's one thing to talk about, of course, a border poll, but it's another thing, as the Brexit referendum illustrated, to get into the detail.
Yeah, Sinead, he mentions a recent book, in that you picked that piece as well, pointing out like things like, are unionists going to want to be an ethnic minority in a united Ireland? Are they going to want guaranteed public jobs, quotas in the guards, etc.? All of these details that we need to think about.
Yeah, that the work needs to be done. It's not a matter of demographics, which I think has been, that's why this week was seen as a seminal moment, because the demographics had always been talked about as the important thing. Eilidh O'Hanlon has a piece as well in the Sunday Independent looking at, I think the conversation shifted quite quickly on the census results from the demographics of the religious makeup to what actually people identified as. And she was looking at that in the maths of who identified as British only, who identified as Irish only, who identified as Northern Irish. And she's saying, well, the maths don't add up to unification yet, because you're saying two thirds of people still don't see themselves as Irish only. And does a United Ireland mean Irish only? So kind of making the same point that there's a lot more work to do. She says Raymond Chandler once said his crime writing colleagues on this side of the Atlantic were great at beginnings and endings, but had no idea what to do in the middle of the stories. And politicians in the North seem to have the same problem, that this is only the middle of the story. It's not like we've got to a point where we have majority of Catholics and therefore we're at the end. There's a lot to figure out.
It's almost quaint, Cormac, that we are defining people by their religion still, isn't it, in the modern world?
It is, but in Northern Ireland, it's the badge of identity and nationalist.
But it's odd when
it's almost synonymous.
Yeah,
I lived for the first 10 years of my life in Northern Ireland, and I really didn't notice that there were these serious tensions when we left in 1970. It strikes me that the melting of the blocks, so the biggest growth has been in people who don't identify as nationalist or unionist or as Catholic or Protestant. Now, it's not a huge block, but it's growing. I think that block is going to force a greater degree of civility on the whole debate. The fact that there's a big block in the middle who are effectively going to be the swing voters means that aggressive posturing is likely to weaken your side rather than strengthen it. And that actually may force a greater degree of civilization in the way we proceed forward with this debate.
OK, we'll go to Ukraine now, if you put on your headphones. And before we came on air, I spoke to Channel 4's international editor, Lindsay Hilsum. I began by asking her where she is.
I'm in Kryvyi Rih. That is Zelensky's hometown. And it's also on the border of Kherson. That's the area which is partly occupied by the Russians, where they're having one of these sham referendums today.
Okay, and can you tell me about the how the sham referendum is working? We've seen footage of armed soldiers going around to people's houses, literally up and down the stairs of their apartment buildings.
Yeah, I've seen some of the same footage, but I was in a village a couple of days ago, and it was a village called Visopilia, and the head of the village there, she told me that of the 22 villages under her command, as it were, or administratively responsible for, six remain under Russian occupation. They are no longer under Russian occupation where she is, because the Ukrainians retook the area 3 weeks ago. But she's in touch with people there. She said that the people she was speaking to, friends and family, say that they absolutely do not want to take part in this referendum. They will not take part in this referendum. But her great fear was that they would be forced to take part in the referendum at gunpoint.
What is the mood, Lindsay, among in the recently liberated villages in the area where you are? I presume the people are very traumatized by what they've been through.
Well, I think that the mood is relief, you know, because they lived under Russian occupation for 6 months, because many villages in this area were taken by the Russians right at the beginning of the war, at the beginning of March. And you look around and nearly every building is badly damaged. So in this village as I was in, Russian artillery had destroyed part of the hospital and the school. And many houses were very badly damaged. And people were really concentrating on their physical needs, because, you know, they need aid, they need food, they need rebuilding materials. And so people were queuing to get these goods which were provided by the Ukrainian government. And that was what their minds were on more than anything else, just trying to rebuild their lives. And, you know, that's going to take a long time and a lot of money. And we could hear the pounding of artillery in the background. So these people are still living in a war zone. The trauma isn't over.
And we see today that President Zelensky has offered a guaranteed safety for Russian soldiers who surrender. What is the reaction to that?
Well, I think that sort of offer has been there for a while, and there have been reports of Russian soldiers who just don't want to fight. But I think that, you know, some of the Russian soldiers, they would fear what would happen to them if they surrendered to the Ukrainians. And although President Zelensky and others have said, you know, you will be fine, you know, we will treat you well, I'm not sure that all Russian soldiers would necessarily believe that, because, you know, this is a war and there's a lot of anger on both sides. And to surrender to the enemy, the people you've been fighting, is not an easy thing to do.
Yeah. When you say that about the anger on both sides, do I sense as well a little bit of the tension in some of the recently liberated areas between people who maybe went along with things for their own reasons and to survive and everything, and people who held out more against the Russians?
Absolutely. And, you know, in the lightning counteroffensive in Kharkiv in the northeast, in the days after that happened, there were long queues of cars going north up to cross the Russian border. And these were people who had cooperated, or what many Ukrainians would say, collaborated with the Russians, because they were afraid of what would happen to them if they stayed behind. And, you know, all of those arguments and problems that you get between neighbours in any village or any town, these things get exacerbated. I was in Izyum, which is one of the largest towns, which was retaken by the Ukrainians a couple of weeks back. And there was a couple who were telling me about the couple down the road who had collaborated with the Russians and how they'd come and threatened them with a grenade and so on. And then, you know, we dug a little more and we found out that the couple who they said were pro-Russian, well, they were very friendly with the husband's first girlfriend. You know, it's all of the stuff like that which gets exaggerated in this situation. But what she said, the wife in this couple, she said, you know, the people who collaborated with the Russians, she said, they're just sitting at home like mice and they don't dare come out.
Yeah, so it's a very complicated picture for going forward for all these places, isn't it? We're also seeing queues of cars in the opposite direction, Lindsay. Obviously, a lot of reports here of Russian men being rounded up in out-of-the-way villages at the far reaches of Russia, and secondly, of young men fleeing Russia.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that one of the interesting things about this mobilization is that it really brings the war home to ordinary people in Russia. Because, of course, President Putin has said that this is not a war, it's a special military operation. And, you know, the whole tenor of the thing has been that this is minor, it's just we're doing the right thing, just to sort things out in Ukraine, it's not going to really affect you. Well, now people in Russia are finding out that it really is going to affect them. And obviously that makes a huge difference. But one of the interesting things is most of the soldiers you'll find, the Russian soldiers, are from more remote parts of Russia and poorer parts of Russia. They're not, on the whole, from Moscow and St. Petersburg and so on. And so far, the mobilization seems to have occurred primarily in those more remote areas in the north and in the far east. And that, I think, is political, because President Putin and the Russian government know that if they start trying to round up hundreds or thousands of people from Moscow and St. Petersburg, particularly the middle class, then that will cause many more political problems for them. So this is, you know, this is a difficult moment for the Russians.
Lindsay Hilsum, Channel 4's international editor, speaking to me earlier. Donika, can I get your take on some of this? Interesting what Lindsay was saying there, that Putin's still trying not to upset the infamous Moscow mothers. And we've seen those videos of people being rounded up in out in the steppes and that kind of thing. Is it wishful thinking by us to think that there's some kind of tipping point going on here in Russia in terms of how the public are feeling about this special military operation slash war?
It's not wishful thinking, but it's impossible to know in advance, you know, because in a dictatorship, people keep their heads down and protests, you know, which are usually held Yeah, I mean, people will only protest when the cost of doing nothing is greater than the cost of doing something. And that's a very rare moment. But we saw how in, you know, I was in East Germany, for example, in 1989, in Dresden, when Putin was in the same city. I met communist leaders there who assured me that this was a regime that was going to last for decades, and it collapsed 3 months later. The Soviet Union similarly collapsed very, very quickly. So, you know, this will not be heralded far in advance. I mean, and I mean, Putin is feared rather than loved in Russia, and therefore his power is based on the aura of invincibility, of having a monopoly of coercive power. If he's seen to weaken, and he is certainly, you know, showing signs of that, not only domestically but internationally. I mean, that was very evident during the recent meeting of the United Nations when, you know, he couldn't really find any support. Sergei Lavrov couldn't find any support. Even the North Koreans have said that they're not supporting or giving any aid to Russia. India, China have backed away in recent times. So he's feeling it internationally.
Turkey have become a bit more critical as well, haven't they? More even-handed.
And they made it clear that Crimea should be returned to Ukraine. So this is kind of, you know, paralleling, you know, the internal dissension throughout Russia, and as the interviewee rightly said, you know, there was this certain assumption that, you know, it wasn't going to affect everybody, that this was an isolated thing. I mean, I see one of the articles in the Mail, for example, there's reference to a university in Ulan-Ude, which is a university in the far east of Russia, which I visited many, many times, gave lectures there, and they're talking about the students being rounded up and sent to brought to lecture theatres for enlistment. You know, this is remarkable. And I see it. I mean, I know many people in Russia, and you know, you can see this kind of shift. Now, of course, Ukrainians are very cynical of this shift. Their attitude is that people weren't protesting when Russians were killing Ukrainians, but now that their own lives are in jeopardy, they're mobilizing. But for every person who mobilizes, there's certainly a lot more who are very, very upset. And those cues that are people are streaming out, not just towards Europe, where it's more difficult these days, but towards Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan. There's a very good article in the Business Post, a 2-page spread. Donald McNamee, Casualties of War. He interviews two Ukrainians, prominent Ukrainians in Ireland, and one person from Russia. And the person from Russia, Svetlana Shumova, she says that, I'm just trying to go through her family here, it's remarkable. She says, yes, her cousin quit her job on the day of Putin's announcement, fled to Uzbekistan. This is the announcement of mobilization. Yeah. Her brother-in-law left Moscow for a new job in Dubai. Her friend has a new job, and her two brothers-in-law are on the Kazakhstan border. I mean, just people are just fleeing.
I've been thinking a lot this week about a thing you said to me, I think, the last time you were in here, which is that Putin does not have a retirement plan. A dictator does not have a way of kind of, you know, heading off into the sunset. That retirement often means death, right? So does that mean that, like, he's not going to back down? Like, losing's not an option for him, is it? So he'll do anything else rather than lose.
Well, the stakes are higher for a dictatorship. That's certainly true. But, you know, and we saw that, for example, with the Argentinian war, with the Falklands dictatorship collapsed the following year when they lost the war. But, you know, there have been, again, take the Soviet example, because there's so much continuity between the Soviet and the post-Soviet. There have been examples of, you know, Communist Party leaders, think of Khrushchev, who've just been dislodged and moved aside when, in his case, it was the Cuban Missile Crisis and other adventures that didn't work out. You know, he was seen to be humiliated and he was moved aside. So it doesn't have to end in a nuclear apocalypse, as people are all saying.
But it'll need people close to him.
It's much more likely that he'll be taken out, so to speak. I don't mean in terms of losing his life, but taken out by his inner circle rather than a popular mobilisation.
Okay. All right, we'll take a break. Sinead O'Carroll, Donico back on, Michelle Murphy and Cormac Lucy staying with us.
Text 51551. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back. Sinead O'Carroll, Donico back on, Michelle Murphy and Cormac Lucy still with us. Michelle, we just have a few minutes left, but I want to come back home to Cherry Orchard and the events out there. I think really kind of... struck a chord with people in different
ways.
They
did, and they feature in all the papers this morning. And I suppose what it does show is that, you know, generations of deprivation, what it actually does to community. And if young people don't have economic opportunities, if they don't see economic opportunities for themselves, if we don't have perhaps the services and infrastructures you'd see in other areas, if you don't have the same levels of educational attainment, you know, community representation, then these are the kind of things that happens when there aren't, you know, opportunities for young people. And it's, you know, this is not a new story. You know, this has been happening in different areas, deprivation. It just happens to be today's headlines. But if you don't invest in communities. And when I mean investing
and
in
some people are arguing, though, that there are facilities out there, there are schemes and everything else, but maybe it sounds like we're not getting into the families. Is that it at an early enough stage?
Yes, but how many businesses, for example, are setting up out there? Like, what are the economic opportunities for someone leaving school there, or someone leaving a further education course, or how many in the community even go on to third level education? If you don't see those economic opportunities in your community, even if the people who go on and do that move to another community to work, etc., then, you know, young people don't see their options. For example, how many of the teachers there, primary and secondary school, are actually from the local area? I think those are the kind
so
of things.
So, Cormac, if you've no stake in society, what else are you going to do? Get your kicks? And
well, I don't think it would be a great message to go out that if you do not see such a stake in your life, that you should then proceed to act as some have.
We're not endorsing it, but we're saying that is it understandable that it happens?
I think the record would show that people who keep families intact, who stay in study, where there are multiple generation families that have strong relations with each other, that they do better. And I think there are a lot of broken homes. I mean, I'm legally separated, so I'm no poster boy on this front. But the traditional values were there for a reason. They were not the entire answer, obviously not. But I think to swing from that and say, if the state cannot provide everything to you, that somehow then ramming a car at somebody else is understandable. I don't think it's understandable in any context other than one where your own life is in danger.
Yeah. Michelle, interesting though, I think, are you both agreeing that, and this has been part of the commentary during the week, that find the community in general, do we need to get back in supporting families? That's where everything's
isn't it? And what you're ultimately looking at is
that the government then into people's houses?
Well, you're looking at the cost of poverty, because it costs €1 in every €20 that we take in as an exchequer to deal with. And what I mean by the cost of poverty, I mean poor health outcomes, poor economic outcomes. So you're less likely to have a job, poor educational outcomes. You're more likely in poor, you know, substandard accommodation, you're not going to live as long, you're more likely to have a chronic illness. That is the cost of poverty. And if that becomes embedded in a community, then, you know, what are the lifelong outcomes for young
10
people?
10 seconds, Sinead.
We have to have thought about the wider implications of conversations like this on communities. Like, we only feature communities like Cherry Orchard when something like this happens, which is the extreme edge of the wedge. And we have Willie O'Dea talking about feral teenage gangs and then saying that they should respect the state. So he's writing in the Sunday Independent today and he calls them feral teenage gangs, and then in the last paragraph says that they should respect the state more after using language like that.
Yeah, but he's not talking about the community in general.
But this is the only time we're talking about Cherry Orchard, and you know, we have to have, there's implications to that too.
Okay, fair point. Sinead O'Carroll, editor of thejournal.ie, Donegal Bacon, Professor of International Relations at DCU, Michelle Murphy of Social Justice Ireland, and Cormac Lucy of the Sunday Times. Thank you all very much.